those of you who don't know where you are, this is the session on a death in the family. My name is Ron Burke. For those of you who have not been around and don't know who I am the Lutheran campus pastor at Southwest Texas State University in San Marcos, Texas, a university you may not have heard of before, but undoubtedly you have heard of our most famous alumni, Lyndon Baines Johnson. So, whether that is a virtue or a vice, I will leave that up to you. I also, somebody was just telling me, they've listened to my tapes from last week and know that I am aware that people are late sometimes, but I feel that people who are prompt should not be penalized for that, but should be rewarded, so I do some little things for transition, and realizing that there are always people for various reasons who do straggle in. And I am still not warm, so would somebody please close that door? I do a little column and a newsletter and that kind of thing, and called Random Thoughts, sort of a wry eye on the church and things religious, and my transition times are mostly selections from that. This morning, some random thoughts on you begin to wonder about your minister when... You begin to wonder about your minister when he starts wearing stained glass contact lenses. You begin to wonder about your minister when he announces, "There cannot be a crisis next week. My schedule is already full." When he does a medley of his hit sermons. That's what they're going to do with all my tapes. You begin to wonder about your minister when someone calls to ask when the service begins and he says, "What time can you get here?" When he begins a recruitment program for missionaries to the Bermuda Triangle. You have to think about that one a little bit. You begin to wonder about your minister when he wears a robe with Dior on the front. When at a congregational dinner he prays, "Lord, forgive the cooks." You begin to wonder about your minister when people come out of church with chapped ears. When he thinks high cholesterol is an Iranian religious holiday. You begin to wonder about your minister when he tries to exorcise a devil's food cake. When he circulates a petition to make Judgment Day a national holiday. And finally, you begin to wonder about your minister when, for every problem, he has an answer that is quick, easy, and wrong. So there. I assume everybody is here. If you will pardon me, after you stay at Holden Village about a week or 10 days, whether you want it or not, part of the graceful gift that they give you here is a sore throat and a cough and that kind of thing. And I've been here long enough to get that, so I hope that I can get through today's session with a minimum of coughing. The title of this session is A Death in the Family, or subtitled Some Personal Reflections on the Death of a Father. I don't know how long you have been here, but in my time here I've been impressed by the number of people who tell their own story here, and that seems to be a very effective way of communicating, because as we tell our story, it seems to precipitate in hearers their story, and you put all these stories together and you come up with God's story. So this morning I would like to sort of share with you a story out of my life, and it goes back almost 3 years ago, about 2.5 years ago, when my father, who had suffered cancer for 2 years, was in the final stages of that bout with that dreaded disease. And I'm an only child, and I had been with him off and on through that whole period. But finally it became obvious that his days were limited, so I closed up the campus ministry in San Marcos and went to the little hometown of Mason, Texas, about 100 miles away, to be with him in what turned out to be his final 2 weeks of life. And those final 2 weeks of his life were a time of deep reflection for me, his only child, and I preserved a whole lot of those thoughts in my journal. And recently I was rereading those and realized that some things happened to me during that time that were very significant, things of which I would do well to frequently remind myself, and things that might be valuable to share with others who may someday have to face the same ordeal. So for what it's worth, here are some of my very personal reflections on the death of my father. First of all, I learned that there is a good side of death, a good side of death. My father was fortunate in that he suffered none of the excruciating pain that is usually associated with cancer until his very final week. But that was enough. It was nasty, to put it mildly, not just for him, but also for those of us who stood by and felt with him and for him. And I was standing by his bedside when he finally breathed his last, and surprisingly, I found myself smiling. It was a smile of relief for him and relief for me. Finally, he was at peace, and now we could all rest. Ecclesiastes says there's a time to be born and a time to die, and it was my father's time to die. For him to live on in the condition that he was in at that particular time would have been not good. Stuart Alsop has written, a dying man needs to die as a sleepy man needs to sleep. And there comes a time when it is wrong as well as useless to resist. Understanding this good aspect of death made it easier for me to accept my father's death, and I think has done a whole lot to relieve the anxieties, which seem to be very natural in all of us, about our own death. Because of my father's death, I feel that I am much less anxious about my own death. The second thing I learned was something about the importance of a caring community, the importance of a caring community. My hometown of Mason, Texas is a little cow town and Angora goat town and peanut town in the hill country of Texas, about 100 miles north of San Antonio. And as in most small towns, everybody knows everybody. And my father was especially well known since he had been one of the real community leaders from the time that he moved into town from our family ranch some 30 years ago. He had been manager of the Chamber of Commerce. He was Mason County's lone justice of the peace, the law west of the Llano, as they called it. And he had been active in all kinds of community affairs. And when it was discovered that he had cancer, the news spread rapidly, as only it can in a small town. And people quickly began to show their care and their concern for him. Not in great, big, obvious ways, but in all kinds of little, subtle ways. And I can remember one incident in particular. He had been in the hospital in San Antonio for a couple of weeks and was getting ready to go home. And he and his wife, and here I should say that my mother died back in 1965 after a six-year bout with Parkinson's disease, so I am somewhat of an authority on parents who have physical problems. Anyway, as I say, my mother died in 65 and my father remarried a year or so after that. Anyway, he and his wife, who had been in San Antonio, were concerned about how their yard would be when they got home. It was that time of year when the leaves were falling, and since there's all kinds of trees around their house, raking leaves is a big job. I had some conflict at the time, I forgot what, but anyway, I was not able to take them back and go with them. However, our son, Richie, was available, and he was going along to help drive and just be company to them. And I mentioned to Richie their concern about the leaves and suggested to him, as only a father can, that it might be very nice if when they got up there, he would go out and rake these leaves up. Well, I went up, I think, the next day. And when I got there, I was immediately impressed with the condition of the yard when I drove up in front of the house. It was immaculate, mowed, trimmed, raked, not a leaf in sight. And later on, when I had a chance to be with Richie alone, I complimented him on what a good job he had done. But Dad, he said, I didn't do it. It was like that when we got here. Come to find out, some of my dad's friends and neighbors had kept the yard while they were gone, even going so far as to rake the leaves. Now, people cared about my father, and they showed that care in countless ways, quote, little ways like this, and yet they were big things, because he knew they cared, and it meant a whole lot to him. When it was first discovered that he had cancer, the forecast was bleak and gloomy. The doctor, as most doctors are, was reluctant to put a time on how long he had to live, but it is obvious that the doctor was thinking in terms of only months. And yet my father lived for 2 years after the discovery of that cancer. And I was talking to the doctor one day about all of this, and the doctor said that it really didn't have anything at all to do with the medicine or the medical care. It was more a matter of attitude. And my dad had a super attitude. His spirits were excellent throughout this whole ordeal. Now why? Well, I'm convinced it was because he felt the love and care of his friends and neighbors. They were a support group in the very best sense of that word. Their care for him had to be worth a barrel of medicine in sustaining and comforting him during that illness. And why did the community care about my father? Because, well, all kinds of reasons, I'm sure, but a major one had to be because he cared about them. He cared about them. As I said, he had been a community leader of long standing, and one of his pet projects was the Mason County Hospital. He had served on its board for a number of years, and he was its chairman when a few years ago they decided to expand and add on a new wing. And out of his graciousness, he donated rocks, stones, if you call them that, we call them rocks in Texas, from our ranch to be used in the outside wall of that new addition, that new wing. And when he died, he was in that new wing, in a bed, not 3 feet away from this wall of rocks that came from his beloved family ranch. The moral of that story being, as far as I am concerned, that when you care for the community, you are in a very real sense caring for yourself. A third thing I discovered was the therapy of grief, the therapy of grief. As one who grew up on a Texas hill country ranch, I was raised, as you might expect, in a macho society. Sort of a cowboys don't cry culture. A real man does not show his emotions. That can go in that new book, A Real Man Doesn't Eat Quiche. Have you seen that? A real man doesn't cry, doesn't show his emotions. And even though I've come to realize how ridiculous that is, I have to admit that I still have a very difficult time showing my emotions. I hold them in, and only on very, very rare occasions do they get out. And this was true during the whole time of my father's illness until just a couple of days after I had left San Marcos and gone to be with him. And as I was sitting there in his hospital room one afternoon, the inevitability of his death finally hit me. And I began to feel very sad and very melancholy. But as they say at Texas A&M University, where I used to be chaplain, a real macho school if you don't know about that, I sucked it up and made it okay. Later on, after I left the hospital, I went to visit my mother's grave in the cemetery in Mason. And as I stood there, I saw the place where my father would be laid in a very short time. And then as I walked around in this little small town cemetery, I began to see all kinds of graves with names on them of just all kinds of people out of my past. Any number of people that I knew who had been very close friends of my parents and close friends of mine. And that started the memories to flowing and almost the tears, but cowboys don't cry prevailed. And still later on in the day, I drove back out to the ranch, which is about 25 miles out of town, and on a whim stopped at the Union Band Cemetery, a little country community cemetery on the highway about a mile from our ranch. And as I walked into through the gates of that little country cemetery, the first grave that I saw was that of Pete Bartons. Now, you probably never heard of Pete Barton. Most people have not. Pete was, as we called him, an old bachelor. Even when he was young, he was an old bachelor who lived on a little 80-acre place next to ours, and with his coon dogs, his fighting chickens, his one racehorse, and his ever-present pot of coffee, and no wife, he was the envy of every man in the community. And Pete was especially dear to me as a child, and I had not thought of him in a long, long time. And seeing his grave just brought back all kinds of memories and emotions. But again, the cowboy stayed in control. Well, from there, I went on to the ranch, and I got a bottle of scotch, which is okay for Texas Lutheran ministers. I don't know about Minnesota Lutheran ministers, but anyway. And then went up on what we affectionately call the Little Mountain, a hill a couple of hundred yards from our ranch house, from which you can get a panoramic 25-mile view of much of Mason, Llano, and Sinsaba counties, the heart of Texas, if you don't know anything about Texas. And this is an especially good place to watch the sunset and to meditate and to reflect. And that was exactly why I went there. And as I sat on this little mountain, the whole scene of my childhood lay before me. On the right was this rock house that my grandfather had built back in '05, and where he and my grandmother lived. Straight ahead down the road, about a mile or so, was the remains of Pete's house, the place where he used to live. And then on my left was the frame house, which my parents had built back about 1940, and where I had lived as an only child. And suddenly I realized that my dad, the last person left from that cast of characters out of my childhood, was about to leave. From all of those very, very important people in my life, I was about to be the only one left. Little Ronnie was about to have to face life all by himself. Well, that did it. I lost complete control, the dam burst, and this cowboy cried. Cried for the first time in years. And as the Coors beer commercial says, they weren't no downstream tears, folks. They was big old high country cowboy tears. And then it got very dramatic as I began toasting all of these people from my past. To Granddad for putting this ranch together. To Grandma for keeping Granddad happy. To Pete for lots of fond memories. To Mother for her persistence in giving me birth. And to Daddy for keeping this all together just for me. Well, by then the sun had gone down, my bottle of scotch had gone down, and it was time for me to come down off the hill, which I did, loudly singing Amazing Grace. Fortunately, we have no close neighbors. Now, as ridiculous as all this may sound, it was one of the best things that happened to me during that whole time. All of the grief that had been welling up inside of me came out in that one experience. And oh, what a relief it was. The therapeutic value of what happened to me at that time was immeasurable. I went back to my father's bedside the next day cleansed, and I was able to go through his dying, through his funeral, and through the days following with no problems at all. I had let my emotions show, the tears flow. There's a time to laugh and a time to cry, and it was my time to cry, and it was good. A fourth thing that I learned during this time was, how shall I say it, the comfort of continuity, the comfort in continuity. As I sat on that little mountain, lamenting the fact that all of those people from my childhood had left me all alone, I began to realize that they had probably experienced the same emotions I was feeling as people they loved died and left them. Chances were good that my father had sat at the same place, feeling the same emotions after his father died. And chances are good that someday my son will sit in that same place with the same emotions about me. Now that was a remarkably comforting thought to me, that if all of these people who had mourned before me were able to make it, so could I. I remembered Robert Frost, who said, "In three words, I can sum up everything I've learned about life. It goes on." People die, but life goes on. Each of us comes and each of us goes. But while we are here, that's life. That's our chance to make our contribution to history. We are each links in a chain. We didn't just pop into history with no roots. It has taken me a long time to really understand all that stuff in the Old Testament about so-and-so begat so-and-so who begat so-and-so who begat so-and-so. I was looking in the first part of Chronicles the other day, and you know, it's just page after page of that. Why is that in there? Why does this holy book waste all of that space on family lineage? Well, I'm beginning to understand that. That is to tell those people and to tell us today that we just didn't pop into history. We are here because we have roots. Each of us is here because other people were here long, long before us. Ashley Brilliant has a little postcard that says, "I would like to thank the people who kept the world going until I got here." We have a heritage, and we will leave a heritage. Just as we have ancestors, someday we will be ancestors ourselves. Our descendants will look back and thank us for keeping the world going until they got here. And I take a great amount of comfort in that kind of continuity. And we also learn from this kind of continuity. I learned a lot from my father. He taught me how to shoot a gun. He taught me how to ride a horse and drive a car. He taught me a lot about values and morals. In short, he taught me a lot about living. And my father also taught me a lot about dying. The temptation is to stay away from people who are dying. It is not a pleasant experience to be around people that you love and care for as they go through the dying experience. And I have to be honest that I stayed with my father because, as his only child, I felt it was my duty. But as unpleasant as that whole experience was, I'm glad I did it. Not only did my presence mean a whole lot to my father, but his presence meant a whole lot to me. As I watched him face death, it helped me to prepare to face my own death. As my father cut a path for me to follow in so many other ways, so he has done it with death. And because he has died, I think my dying, when it comes, will be easier. Robert Herhold has said, "It's too bad that dying is the last thing we do, because it could teach us so much about living." It may be too late for me to learn anything from my own eventual death, but it is not too late to learn from those who have died before me. That is their gift to me. Well, my father's death was not something I care to go through very often. But as I look back on it, I see what a valuable experience it was for me. Through his dying, I learned something about death, and I learned something about life. And I am certain that what I learned will help me in my living and in my dying. And for that, I am eternally grateful. So, those are some personal reflections on the death of my father. As I said, hopefully my story will precipitate your story, and maybe for the rest of our time together we can share some stories or reactions or whatever you would like to do.
Could I ask about, you talked about continuity.
Yes, sir.
What about these that do not look back upon continuity? You know what I mean? Really have no fathers, no mothers. They don't know who their fathers and mothers are. They may have been adopted, but they still have that hankering within them to know. There's continuity, I know what you mean, but the experience that you have and that we've had in the death of loved ones is one that we feel is a great relationship to history and what went before.
Yes, and I think that's sad for people who don't have that sense of continuity. They can have a general sense, but a specific sense they do not have. Yes. All of us have read or seen Roots, the book and the TV movie, and I think the importance of that for blacks, and I think for all of us, was to emphasize that continuity. In the summer of 80, I had a very emotional experience. I went to Germany and stood in the little village church where my great-grandfather left in about 1849. And this little church was, see if I can remember the dates, it was started, the actual structure was started in 1100, it was added on to in 1400, and it was finished in 1600 something. And to stand there in that building and to realize that this had been my family's church for literally hundreds of years, and no telling how many Burks had been baptized and confirmed and married and buried from that church. That was just a very emotional experience for me. And really, really made me stand in awe of who I am and how I got here. And made me feel a little more important. Gave me a little more self-esteem. I'm somebody because there were a bunch of somebodies before me. I'm not really addressing your question. Yes.
I understand what you mean, because our son is an adopted child, and he has had a lot of problems as far as thinking about his heritage. But what he has done is that he has completely taken on the set of relatives. He's made himself. In his thinking, he's taken on all the relatives, even to the grandparents. And he seems to get a lot of comfort out of the fact that these are his relatives.
Isn't that what adoption's all about?
Yeah, I would hope so, you know, that you adopt you are adopted by a family, and not just your immediate family, but all your historical family. But still, we have lots of people who are adopted and realize that and spend this frantic, sometimes lifetime search for their actual physical family. And that's a fact that I think we have to realize. Yes, sir.
First of all, I want to thank you for the discussion so far, and also the pastor back there who brought up this very hard to answer question about the adopted child, that baby, and identity. It does come out, and we don't have good, fast answers for it. I want to verify your feelings, if you ever had any questions about your feelings, if they were correct, half correct, or whatever, about being able to cry. Is it legal here in the United States, Lutheran? As for myself, I'm somewhat of your background, also a lonely child, only child, whichever way. My father was 92 when he passed away, living with us, my wife and I. It was an easy death, so no problem. I seen all of my grandparents pass away, put pennies on their eyelids, you know, everything at home. No problem. Well, problem, sure, but anyway, I survived. And so did all the others. I made my dad's coffin, by the way. And that kind of raises a few dandruffs and lays the hair down flat, except mine, because I knew what I wanted to do. And I, if you'll tolerate the personal reference I all the time, that's, you'll just have to tolerate it. I had a pre-plan of what was going to happen. I also had a reason for it to happen. This was 2 years ago. As far as I was concerned, and still am, simplified lifestyle is a must. We're all living like two-faced, overpaid hypocrites. That's all there's to it. I don't care where you come from. Every one of you are guilty by degree. Every one of me, likewise. A start of reversal with God's blessing, if you will, is the come down that totem pole, making the box for 30 minutes of viewing. Should it cost $1,000 or less than $20, which the one I made cost. I made it. My grandson helped me. And two grandsons, right. Wife and daughter aligned it. Okay. Still less than $20. At the funeral, I put out $1,000 and told the people if they didn't like what I said or had already done, that was too bad. Mother Teresa was going to get that $1,000 that I now had because I didn't go and join the commercial rat race or putting on a fancy show. The reason why for choosing, I'm Norwegian Lutheran, so you understand that. Mother Teresa is not, okay? She was the only one in my life who was meaningfully doing God's work, never being able to get a thank you in return, much less political recognition or whatever. Giving a drink of water to a dying person, how much feedback are you going to get? That's what she's doing, still doing. I cheerfully gave her the $1,000. There is a book here in the bookstore, Simplified Lifestyle, and this is just one small facet of this total picture. Progress is downward, not going up or sideways. Getting back to the emotion that you're talking about. This, to me, was likewise important. I didn't realize how important until afterwards. At my mother's funeral, which happened 6 years prior to this, my crying took place at the grave site. One time only, and wow, what a relief. Friday afternoon. The following Sunday, I'm ushering out. No problem. Looking at all these many people who we've known since 1937, that's not easy. But it was beautiful because I allowed myself to cry. And that's extremely important. And I'll tell you why I think so, and quite frankly, know so. Knowing several people who cannot cry and have death in their family, today they have headaches like you wouldn't want to listen to them. Some of them are products of missionary people from China. I'm not talking about uneducated people if you think that's important. To me it's not. The more educated a person is, the bigger fool he probably is. I can show you. They're educated in such a narrow field, they're practically no earthly good. Okay? And if you don't believe, go to the city jail, your county jail, your prison like I do every 2 weeks, and meet them. They're there. Don't kid yourself. And you don't look down on them, folks. You help them by just listening. The truth will eventually come out. You have to hang in there. Listen to the door slam behind you. You're now in. Leaving your own prejudices at home, by the way. God didn't send you there for to be a two-faced listener. The people that I know of with this were not allowed to cry. And like I said, to this day, they got pains like you wouldn't want to listen about. So if you're so sophisticated, you're so good, not good, well anyway, sophisticated, let's leave it at that point, that you cannot show God's given facet crying, you're in deep trouble and you're going to stay there in deep trouble.
Thank you for your story. I should tell you that I have not cried since that time. It was very interesting you talked about building the coffin. The church which my father belonged to was vacant at that particular time, and I wanted to preach his funeral sermon. But I chickened out. And probably wisely so. There was a very capable, competent interim pastor, 80 years old, I found out, who was acted like he was about 60, who did an excellent job. But that would have really been pushing it for me, I think, at that particular time. I would have loved to have done it, but it might have backfired. And,
would you say more about that? Is that about crying?
Well, it's probably partly about crying. Yeah, I might have been forced to show my emotions publicly and among all my cowboy buddies. And I think it would have been accepted by them, but I'm not sure I could have accepted it. I cry, but I cry privately. You can analyze me all you want. I'm just trying to be very honest with you. but I think probably... how to say this? I detest funerals that are totally impersonal. But at the same time, I'm a little leery of funerals that are totally personal, and that the gospel sometimes gets left out. And the gospel was heard at my father's funeral, and if I had been trying to preach it, I don't know what would have been heard. It might just have been me.
But you began by saying, you know, in a sense, tell the gospel by telling her.
True, true. I just contradicted myself, didn't I? You caught me. Yeah, I don't know. I just, maybe I should have, but I didn't.
Yeah.
I chose not to, and as Luther said, sin boldly. Sin boldly. If it's wrong, God will forgive it. If it's right, He'll bless it.
What I'm really wondering, you know, how is it that we then begin to give people permission to cry if we continue to know that it's important to be able to share our emotions in our community and yet persist in finding ways to prevent that from happening. I guess the most permission I usually see for expressing emotions is when someone else risks showing their emotion in the community. And I, you know, it's not like you do it everywhere.
Right.
But that, it seems like it's really hard to be the first one.
Yeah, and I feel very strongly about that it is a cultural kind of thing. It's a peer pressure, as they say. My peers don't cry, so I don't cry. My peers start crying, it's okay for me to cry, or laugh, or whatever. And somebody has to be the first one.
Yeah, I guess I'm asking. This is a community of people who are concerned about not being, you know, the last one or the second one or part of the culture. What is it we do? Do we wait until our parent dies and then it's kind of okay? Or,
dare to be different.
You're in kind of a primary position because you're dealing with a community that, you know, the intellectual community, the academic community, where, I mean, you know, in a sense, you're put there where the challenge is the greatest. And in a sense...
Well, I can cry with my intellectual friends. It's my redneck friends I can't cry with.
Well, I'm here, but you said you haven't cried since your father died.
Yeah.
Nothing said happened since then.
Not really. Except I almost cried July 4th at Holden Village. It's so cold. No, I don't really know how to answer that. I honestly don't. Al?
Well, I don't know if the word crying is appropriate, but it seems to me that our emotions, which are tears too, can be joyful. I mean, I find myself stirred very often by things where tears come to my come. And they're not tears of sorrow or tears of crying in a sense, but they are very expressions of feelings that come out that are very meaningful to me, and I don't share them with anybody in particular. That's not the point. Sometimes maybe what amazing grace is, you said amazing grace when you sing that. It's a story. I just well up sometimes. When you come to the point that, where's that verse that says what Christ did for us, you know? There's one verse like that, isn't there? I scarce can take it in. I really do. Sometimes I just well up. Mm-hmm. So I think that it's good for us if we can leave ourselves open to these feelings and not to hold them back. I think at a funeral, if I'm preaching, I have to be in control of it because of the situation. When I'm a pastor, I mean, I don't think a pastor should break up in the middle of a sermon or something, although I've had difficulty sometimes in relationships. But to be open to these things seems to me that's a God-given outlet that's good for us. And I'd like to see more people do that.
Okay, there was someone over here. Back.
No, I was just going to say that I think that you have to practice that. being, letting your emotions come. My husband died 2 years ago, and he was unable to cry, and I was telling him, cry, cry, because he was going through such misery. And I think it was because he had never been allowed to do that. And I feel that I'm of the stoical background too. And at the funeral, I didn't cry because I felt the love of all those people there. And I thought, I'm going to take it all in, and I'm not going to allow myself to just obliterate all this. I want to feel what's happening at the time too. But then also I wanted to say that after that in church I'd sit and there would be reruns and this contemplative thing would bring the tears. And I didn't always feel it was acceptable because of the way others handled it. I felt that I was spoiling it for everyone else. There was one meeting I went to where I completely broke down and was embarrassed and ashamed afterwards. And part of it was that other people started crying and they ignored me. Well, they should have, I think I appreciated them ignoring it, but also I wanted someone to comfort me, that kind of thing. I just didn't feel that it was really all that acceptable.
Tears don't always have to be for sadness, but they can be for joy too.
Yeah, I think that was brought out, yes. Same.
I was just going to confess that my general response to life is to cry. And I think it's both joy and sorrow, but for the past year, I have almost cried every Sunday and at worship. And I've thought I should preach a sermon to explain myself why it is that I'm crying. And what I want to say is that for me, that this place is a healing place. And when I see affirmation and I see like a child taking the offering and he has a big grin on his face, for instance, it makes me cry because I think that that's where there's wholeness, when there's affirmation. And all of my friends accept my crying. And I think at certain points, my kids at church are betting about now, is she crying at this point? And I don't think that it is a burden for them. And that, in fact, I think if they're trying to decide, well, now, at what point is she crying today? I mean, I don't cry, but I tears. And anybody who knows me knows I'm crying. And I just think that it has maybe made them more sensitive to what's happening in terms of that could evoke tears. And I guess I can't be ashamed of who I am. And so that's just a very essential part of accepting that is going to be my response. I'm always the worst one at the funeral. That's just who I am.
Well, and I think that's the key. Each of us is a unique individual. Each of us brings our own, quote, tapes, as the old saying goes, to our present situation. Each of us feels free to express certain emotions and suppress to other emotions. Learning who we are and accepting that, I think, is the key. It's been that for me. It took me a long time. I went through a really tough time when the sensitivity movement, was really big, especially on campus with all my campus ministers, peers, and, show your emotions. Don't keep anything hidden. I moved into an ecumenical center about 7 years ago with some people that I dearly love, but they were right in the big middle of that, and I couldn't come into my office in the morning and go by the secretary's office without being, really probed as to all of my emotional feelings. Oh, what? How are you feeling this morning? And they didn't want just fine. Oh, really? How are you? And I got so sick and tired of being psychoanalyzed every morning, I started slipping in the back door. And I got very self-conscious about the fact that I am an emotional introvert, that I do not show my emotions. And felt very guilty about that. And I tried for a while to share and to show my emotions, and I was miserable because that was not me. I was wearing somebody else's mask. And finally, I just sat down and said, well, let's really take a long look at Ron Burke and see who he is and what emotions he can show and be real and honest to himself. And I found out, okay, I'm a cowboy. And I come out of that culture. And like it or not, that's, you know, who I am. And I've learned to accept that. And for me, that's okay. Don't worry about me that I don't cry. I don't worry about you that you do cry. That's great.
I think that's the point that we have to get at.
Absolutely.
And
I'm willing to let you cry anytime you want to. If I can not cry anytime I want to. That's the only honest way I know to deal with the situation. Well. Yes, sir.
I think the way that you handled your father's death was a very healthy one. But there are groups of people who use the defense mechanism of denial. And I see this in my practice. And I remember a couple months ago, I had a man in with advanced cancer of the lung. And I tried to prepare him for what was coming, and I knew it would be less than 2 weeks that he was gasping. So I said, Bill, are you interested in staying home when you pass away? And his wife popped up and says, Doctor, we don't talk like that. She denied the fact that this man is going to die. He said, my husband isn't going to die. And here he was, just was one step away. And I could never discuss it with him. And they're the people who have real problems when the event comes about. And I see this even in patients. If we operate on someone and we find a mass in the abdomen, a patient who uses denial will never ask you what you found. They'll never even bring the subject up. You walk into the room, and they'll be talking about something else. They'll never ask you, what did you find? And it's sort of a defense mechanism. It seems to work, but it seems to be unhealthy. And I think your problems come about later on after the event.
But those people that are going to die, maybe for them, that is the best way for them to handle it.
Yeah, that's right.
Maybe not for the people who are left behind, but for the person that's dying, not everybody that has a disease is going to die from it can handle it best by facing it like that. And so, therefore, they ought to have the right to do what is going to make them feel most comfortable until
their death. Well, I wonder if part of it lies, too, in a fear of a loss of control, that if I open this door to this experience or this emotion, I'm going to be totally out of control. My brother died 12 years ago, unexpectedly, at the age of 35. And I got the news over the telephone. 20 minutes later, I taught a class. And in 20 minutes, I cried. And then I taught the class. And then after the class, I cried. And the same thing with conducting funeral services for people who become very important and precious to you. I think it's often important to me as a pastor to have control over the situation, not to, you know, completely lose my capacity to be helpful in the middle of that situation because of my own personal loss of control. And I have discovered that I can control the emotions, that there are times when, you know, I can let it roll, you know, but I can check it, and I can function if I'm required to function, and I can not function if I don't have to function. And there's great freedom for me in knowing that I can be emotional. And if I'm called upon to be non-emotional, I can be non-emotional. And that there's that degree of control over it. I think a lot of people are afraid to risk making that discovery. That if I let it out, I'm not going to be able to rein it back in. And I'm going to be completely out of control when I don't want to be there.
Yes, control is a big factor with me. I really, you know. Took me a long time to figure out why I didn't like to fly. And finally dawned on me because I wasn't flying that machine. And I didn't know what that character was doing up front. You know. I like to fly little planes rather than big ones because I can watch the pilot. And if he gets excited, I get excited. A big plane, you know, I can't see. And the guy's telling me everything's fine and dandy, you know. But I don't know. But that control is a big thing, and emotions and everything else with me. Somebody else was. You brought up a point, very interesting. My father, again, culture, well, two things. One, it was very interesting to me when, as I said, he did not really have any pain until the final week. And when that started hitting him, it was pretty tough. But again, his cowboy culture came out. And he really found it hard to admit that he was feeling pain. But there were times when it was very obvious. And by that time, the doctors had left instructions that whatever he wanted for pain, it was his. And they have, what is it? They called it a Molotov cocktail or something with a mixture of everything, you know, it's opium. And it, boy, it's supposedly, I was sitting there kind of wanting some of that myself. And they had explained it to him and told him what it was and that he could have it any time, and it comes in a little shot glass, and, you know, all this stuff. And I was sitting with him, and it was obvious that he was in real pain because he was showing it. And so I suggested to him, I said, "You want something for your pain?" "No." And he kept on, and I finally said, "You know, it's really kind of ridiculous for you to sit here and experience that pain when there's something right here that'll ease it." And finally he said something which I thought was very revealing. He said, and here's a man who was knew he was going to die within a week. He says, "Well, I really don't want to take that stuff because I'm afraid I'll get hooked on it." That was all of his culture coming out, you know. And I just had to laugh at him. And respect that. But finally, he got hurt, and so that he took his little shot. But that, I think, really reveals something about the peer pressure that we feel sometimes. And the other thing I wanted to say, and this is another part of confession, and I hope you will just accept it as that, is that another part of my cultural background is that men don't express their emotions to each other. My father and I unquestionably had deep love for each other, but I never said to my father, "I love you," and my father never said to me, "I love you." In that final time of his, I sat there, and we would sit together in a long time, just silent, just really saying, you know, "I'd really like to say that, but I never could say that." And I felt regret about that for a while, but I've made my peace with that too, because that was not a part of our relationship. And it would have been very embarrassing and destructive, I think, to both of us if I'd have stood there and, you know, done that. But I was saying that in all kinds of ways, I think, without words. And I have to trust that communication takes place other than just words. Well, I share that as partly as confession, but also to maybe if some of you get in that same situation, I find lots of people that find it very, very hard to express emotions to people who are very close to them. It's sort of an inverse relationship or something, that the people you're closer to, you find it harder to express your true emotions about them. I can say I love you to all kinds of people that I have a very superficial relationship with, but to say that to someone I really, really deeply love, it's a little harder. I don't know whether that's true of anybody else or not. Maybe that's a peculiarly cowboy ethic. The John Wayne ethic.
Yeah, I think you're alluding to this, but I think it's essential that as we go through the death experience with someone that we remember that we're forgiven, and maybe we'll be what we think is very appropriate surrounding somebody that we love and that is dying. But I think that we also need to accept the forgiveness that we know that we have and that we're not going to be perfect people even in the experience of our death or a loved one's death. And that's okay.
Yeah. Well, our time is up. If you're saying, gee, all you did was talk about death in this life and not after the afterlife, well, I did it all Monday night for those of you who were at Vespers. And as I said then, I think death, you know, if there's a common fear in life, it's the fear of death, but if there's a common fact of life, it's death. We're going to die, people around us, and if we don't face up to that and deal with it, we're just sticking our heads in the sand, and that's kind of what I'm trying to do. And which is a lead-in again, if you have not gotten a copy of that parable that was used Monday night, there are copies available. Thank you very much. Have a live day.